David Flaherty, Marketing Director for Washington Wine, and this is Somlight. Somlight is a conversation series where we talk to some of our favorite wine pros around the country, talk a little bit of shop, but mostly find out what makes them human and what makes them tick. I'm incredibly honored today to welcome Jill Zamorski to the show. Born and raised in Charlottesville, Virginia, Jill has more than 20 years of industry experience and has worked for several world-class chefs, most notably Charlie Palmer, Jose Andres, and Grant Achatz. She was the first beverage director for Think Food Group, where she oversaw the wine and cocktail programs for all of Jose Andres' DC restaurants. She later worked as a sommelier at Alinea Restaurant in Chicago and was eventually promoted to wine director for the Alinea Group. She became a master sommelier in 2018, one of 269 worldwide and one of only 26 women in the United States. Oh, and she's completed 6 marathons. Jill, it's awesome to see you.
Welcome to Sunlight. It's nice to see you too.
Where are you and how are you?
I'm great. And I will, to answer that in opposite direction, I'm in Chicago and I'm doing great. Thank you.
Okay. So you love college basketball.
I do.
I'm going to hold up 2 pictures and I want you to tell me what they are and tell me how they make you feel.
Okay.
Number one.
Wahoo. It makes me feel very happy. My heart starts to go pitter pat.
What is it?
That is the University of Virginia logo, my alma mater, and the men's national champions from 2019 and also 2020 because COVID. they just kept their title for another year.
Yeah, that's not so bad. That's not a bad deal.
No, it's great.
All right, number 2.
Boo hiss.
Boo.
No me gusta.
I take it those are your rivals.
Yes, arch nemesis.
So, Jill, you have run. You have run 6 marathons.
I have.
You've worked all over the country from DC to Aspen to Chicago. What are you running from?
That's a great question. The first time I did a marathon, it was kind of a dare, just to see, you know, and I like kind of the idea of setting a goal and working towards it. Keep in mind, I do not run fast. And so like, there's no aspirations of like, I don't know, setting any kind of like records or winning anything. It's just more to like, see if I can do it. And, you know, anyone can do a marathon. You just have to prepare. And that's the key to it. And so I kind of got into a habit with the group I was running with, when I was still in DC. And that's when I did the first 5. And then I took a little bit of a break and I did my 6th one last year. I ran the Chicago Marathon for my 2nd time. I don't think I'm going to do it anymore. I think I'm done.
I love your confidence in humanity that you're like, you could run a marathon.
Anyone can. You just have to prepare.
I can't. I ran a half marathon in Brooklyn like 10 years ago and I almost died.
That's a really nice race distance, I feel, because it's like significant. You feel very accomplished.
But
it's not quite as physical, like physically painful as a marathon.
Oh my God, I can imagine. So you've wanted to be many things growing up other than a sommelier. What were some of those things?
Oh man. Well, when I was younger, when I was in college, I used to think I wanted to go to law school. And then that was actually my plan. And then it sort of morphed into, I wanted to go into like work for the FBI or something like that and go into like federal law enforcement. That didn't happen either. And like a lot of people in the hospitality industry, I kind of fell into it by accident through a part-time job. And, you know, you get bit by the hospitality bug. And first I just was working in restaurants. I wasn't even working specifically with wine. And then I realized after meeting, a great friend and influential sommelier who I got to know that working with wine can be a lot more fun sometimes than managing a staff, you know, it like generally shows up on time and it generally smells good and you don't have to have hard conversations with the wine. And so I realized that you could actually like build a career in wine.
Yeah. You didn't like sit your wine glass down and be like, look, you've been coming in late 5 days in a row now. Your station's a mess.
You don't have to write it up.
You have to write up a glass of wine.
Never.
So you were watching a lot of X-Files. You wanted to be an FBI agent. I did too. I hear you. But then you went on. I mean, you know, despite the marathons and all the amazing credentials you have, which are many, you've worked for some of the greatest chefs in America. I mean, Charlie Palmer, Jose Andres, Grant Achatz. I mean, that is like, you work with one of those chefs and that's an accomplishment. You worked with all 3. What are some things that you learned from them that you still use today?
good question. So when I worked at Charlie Palmer Steak in DC, I didn't really have much interaction with Charlie Palmer, but that was a really pivotal place in my career because that was sort of, that's where I met my friend Nadine, who was the wine director. And that's how I really understood, got to understand and learn about like what a sommelier does. And from there, I applied for my first job as a sommelier and have never looked back ever since. So it was a very pivotal place in my career, and it was a very powerful and significant wine program. So it, I did learn a lot from that restaurant, but I didn't have as much interaction with Charlie. When I worked for Jose Andres and Think Food Group, I spent 6 years with that company, and it was a really important part of kind of my professional development. And early on, even, I think that this company took an approach that I don't know that a lot of other restaurant and hospitality companies do. They sort of had this idea that they would grow, you know, staff or younger managers into like grow you into a GM or grow you into a wine or beverage focused role. And like our CFO would have a class with all of the managers all across the company and like teach everyone how to read a P&L and like how to understand if your inventory isn't like, if it's not making sense, like how to figure out where the problem is. And so relatively early in my career, I got to learn the kind of stuff that some people are never straight up instructed on. They're just kind of figuring out as they go. And so that was pretty awesome. Plus there was a really kind of a very important focus on beverage in that company, but all different types of beverage, because lots of the different restaurants had different focuses and different kinds of, you know, cocktail programs. And we also, the company also expanded really rapidly while I was there. And so I got to take part in a bunch of different openings, and opening a restaurant, if you've ever done that, is no small feat. And that can teach you so much about, you know, organization and your work ethic and sleep deprivation and, you know, getting stuff done. And so I learned a lot. When I was working for Think Food Group.
You know, like I was fortunate one time to see Jose Andres and Ferran Adria playing blackjack in Vegas. And like, I mean, Jose Andres is like, I don't know him. I've never worked with him. What an incredible soul. I mean, what he's done at his restaurants, the experimental level that he works at. But then with World Central Kitchen, he has to have, I'd imagine, this team of people around him that are just badasses, right? Like what type of people, and it seems also like, and you fall into this camp too, you have to have a lot of energy, I'd imagine, to work with that guy. Just like a mile a minute. What type of people stick with him and really thrive?
Well, I think it's a combination of different types of people, because you need different styles of personalities and different folks. I mean, you need really very creative, outside of the box thinkers. And then you also need people who can get things done, and maybe the less sexy or the less glamorous sides of the business, like, but just put the wheels into motion and get it done. So different types. There are folks at Think Food Group who were there when I was there, and I left in 2011. And then, you know, a lot of other people have gone on and done really incredible stuff, opened their own restaurants and stuff like that. So it's a real mix of personalities for sure, but high energy was a big part of it. And I can't say enough nice things about him. He's a really great person. And, you know, it's one of my favorite stories is right after the Master Sommelier exam in 2018, like everyone kind of goes their different way and whatever. And I went with some folks to like a beer bar to get some beers. And I very consciously like didn't answer my phone. I mean, I called my parents, but like I did not answer texts. I did not look at Facebook or anything like that. And I was sitting there with some friends, you know, kind of in the celebration, you know, basking kind of glow. And I look at my phone and Jose was calling me. And so I stepped outside of the bar and chatted, and he had just, you know, seen, or someone had advised him. I hadn't worked for him for years. I actually hadn't talked to him in a year or two, and he was calling to congratulate me. And he didn't have to do that, but oh my God, it meant so much. And every time I see him now, which is not terribly frequent, he's nothing but kind and generous. And I think his work speaks volumes for him and his family and his company. And I got nothing but nice things to say about him.
You probably know him. I think his name is Lucas Paella.
Yeah.
That's not his name. It's not Paella. And it's not papaya. My wife was on the opening PR team for the Cosmopolitan Hotel.
Oh, yeah.
And Lucas at the time, I guess he might've had your role. He was, I believe, the beverage.
I was still, so when the Cosmopolitan was opening, Lucas was working at the Bazaar in Beverly Hills. Okay. So he was the beverage director for the projects in that hotel. So we were both in Vegas at that time. I did not know your wife was the PR, the marketing for the Cosmopolitan. I lived there for like a couple months while
we were
opening.
Oh my God, we were probably there at the same time because it was like friends and family and the hotel had not opened yet.
Correct.
And we were doing like all the dine arounds and I didn't have anything to do. It was like the greatest thing I've ever done because I didn't have to.
Oh, it was insanity. But it was like, you know, people are like, that's so glamorous. I'm like, no. The hotel was still being opened. Like there wasn't room service and housekeeping and anything like that. Like the guy that I worked with who was in charge of all of the cocktail programs, we worked really closely together to build these beverage programs. And after like a couple days after we'd, you know, gotten there, he's like, Jill, who do you think I talked to about like getting a pillow? And I'm like, oh, and you don't have a pillow? And he's like, I mean, no, but it's cool. And I'm like, no, we can find you a pillow. But like, it sounds really glamorous. Like, oh, I'm going to go out to Vegas and open restaurants. And like opening restaurants isn't that glamorous at all.
Well, I remember Lucas, like he made us some crazy cocktail. Like I forgot, he like heated something up and like stuck it in the glass and it like cooked the liquid. But like, you know, that creativity with beverages, did you get to stretch your wings with cocktails working under Jose Andres?
I did. So in particular, the first place I worked when I started working for Jose was Cafe Atlantico and Mini Bar. So Cafe Atlantico is no longer a thing, but Mini Bar was a restaurant inside of Cafe Atlantico. And at that time it was only a 6-seat tasting menu with, you know, experimental cuisine, 2 seatings a night. And as part of my training, you know, you spend shifts in the kitchen. And this is not exclusive to Think Food Group, but like a lot of times when you start working a new place, you spend shifts in the kitchen, you spend shifts in all the front of the house positions. And I spent several shifts at Mini Bar. And so I learned, and you know, I still have my Moleskine notebooks, but like you learn all the recipes for the spherifications and the gelifications and like how to make all this stuff. And I remember specifically thinking to myself, and I was like, man, it would be such a shame and a waste of my time working this company if I didn't come away with like new skills and new abilities. And that style of making cocktails, it's not appropriate for every venue, but I was determined to understand how to do those things because I thought, I mean, what else am I here for if I'm not going to learn and develop?
I mean, it's like Willy Wonka.
Very much so.
Kind of stuff that they do. Then you went to Alinea.
Well, Grant, I stopped off in Colorado first.
Yeah. Deep in the Rocky Mountains. What was your experience like working in Aspen?
It was great. I mean, I wanted a change from DC, so that's a change, right? Moving from a global capital city and East Coast into a little resort town in the Rocky Mountains. And I had a couple of friends out there already that I knew. And so it wasn't like just all strangers, but it's really different. I mean, I have worked in hotels and restaurants in various places throughout my career, but in a resort town, in a seasonal resort town, it is really different because you go for 3 months and then you just shut down. And that was my first experience with that sort of thing where literally the hotels and the restaurants close and all the stores close and it becomes a ghost town for a couple weeks to a couple months. And then things open back up, you know, for the winter. And then the same thing happens in the mud season in the spring. So it's really an unusual schedule. You have to be very smart about, you know, your finances because there are going to be long stretches with no income and no possible way to make any money because everything is closed, but there is literally no prettier place on earth. And like, you can't not be outside all the time. The mountain's just right there. So you're going to go hike or like, you're going to go ski or snowboard. I mean, I'm sure there are people who live there who don't do either, but it's so easy. It's right there. And so it's wonderful. The quality of life is supreme.
I'm from Fort Collins, Colorado originally. And I've got a lot of friends that have kind of done the, you know, ski bum, ski town life. And if I'm not mistaken, it's like not how many years you've worked there, it's how many seasons. Everyone's like, I haven't done season 12 and whatever. Like, how many seasons were you there for?
Three. Yeah. Which is not that long. I was there for 3 years. So, you know, it's interesting. I love living there. And I will say this there. How do I say this? To make sure I don't like stick my foot in my mouth. Life moves more slowly in a lot of ways. And I was kind of coming from a little bit more of a faster pace. And the style of restaurants, the style of cuisine, it was just after a while, I was looking for something a little bit more, not modern, but just more cutting edge, more current. And so it's so random how it happened. I was just starting to think like, I love it here, but also like, I'm starting to miss all the other stuff. And look, Aspen's not a very diverse town. I mean, I used to joke that French bistro was ethnic dining in Aspen because there's just not much, right? Yeah. And I've always liked living in cities, and I had contacted a friend and a professional acquaintance, and I was like, I'm thinking about like maybe looking to move on. If you know of anything, you know, like, would you mind keeping your ears open? And he was the director of operations for Alinea and the Alinea group. And he's like, why don't you come to Chicago and stage? And so I did. I came to Chicago for 2 days, staged at Alinea, and they offered me a job and I accepted it.
Those are like completely different cultures.
Yeah.
To go from Jose Andres, Willy Wonka world, to ski bum paradise, to like working a couple of shifts at Alinea where you just walk in the door, throw on your nice clothes, and you're like hitting the floor. Like, what was that stage like?
Well, when you stage, it's interesting. You can't, that's a thing that is not even as common as it used to be. And so a lot of places don't accept stages, but you really can't do much for so many reasons, especially at a place like Alinea where the service is very highly choreographed. I didn't know the food. I certainly couldn't be present at the table when the food was being dropped or, in, you know, explained, because I don't know anything about it. I was just there. So I was like a fly on the wall trying to stay out of the way, but watching. But it was really, in terms of like non-restaurant kind of things, I realized very quickly once I moved to Chicago that my clothes, one, I had to spend more money than I wanted to getting, like revamping my wardrobe, because all anyone wears in Aspen is either what they wear to work, and then like jeans, fleeces, vests, and things like that. Like I had no middle ground. And so I was like, okay, I guess I have to buy some clothes again. And also I feel like in the mountains, like everyone wears really bright colors, whether they're like doing anything kind of sporty or whatever. And people in Chicago wear a lot of black and gray. And so I have very bright colors of clothes. And every now and then if I like get something and it's like black or gray, I'm like, okay, I'm clearly getting used to Chicago after 5 years. I don't know. It's a weird observation, but.
Is that rigidity of fine dining? You know, obviously Jose Andres at that level, it's fine dining as well. But even within the fine dining world, I'd imagine the culture of Jose Andres and the culture of Grant Achatz are different, no?
Oh yeah. Yeah, very much so.
How do you find your place in that world without losing your mind? I mean, I'd imagine with the stress, with the demands, like you got to ramp up quick.
You know, there's, for getting used to the situation at Alinea, you know, everybody will run food for a while. So you learn the layout and you learn like the coursing and the timing. And the timing, I think, is one of the biggest things. I was coming in with a lot of wine knowledge. And so, and they say this about, you know, if you're an accomplished sommelier, like the idea that they should be able to like drop you onto a restaurant floor somewhere with a wine program, and you should be able to like, I don't know, figure something out, you know, you should be able to make something happen. And so it wasn't so much from the wine perspective. It was, you know, eventually there's obviously a learning curve with like the timing of service. And then it was a little bit of a challenge to figure out how that restaurant and that company worked. It was really different from both Think Food Group and my time in Aspen, because I'd always had really like very friendly, cordial relationships with the chefs in places I'd worked. I always thought like chef sommelier, these are the people, you know, the pastry chef, these are the people that you want to know in the restaurant. And that was not my experience at Alinea. It was kept very, very separate. And I was really kind of surprised, like if I was like to, I don't know, try to engage in conversation or talk about that, it wasn't terribly well received. And that was a little bit of a disappointment, but you just learn how they operate and you move on.
Yeah. How long were you at Alinea for?
Only a year. Not nearly. I thought I would be there longer, but I was approached by a recruiter for the position or for the company that I work with now. And I thought about it for a long time. I mean, for a long time. I thought about it for over the course of, you know, several weeks, maybe might have even been like 2 months. Lots of conversations, multiple interviews, lots of me asking a lot of questions, because I don't work on the restaurant floor anymore. And that would be a big move to consider leaving the floor, because there's a little bit of a, I don't know, like a belief that in the restaurant world, when you step off the floor, most people don't go back for various reasons. And so I was, you know, it was not a path that I had envisioned for myself. It kind of landed in my lap, but it's a sweet gig, you know, with some great wines. And so I thought maybe this is an interesting opportunity.
So now you're the champagne specialist.
Well, so my role has evolved, but yeah, I started off and for 3 years worked as a champagne specialist. So I it's like a triangle relationship. There's a distributor who sells the wines. And then Moët Hennessy, of course, is the company that owns these producers of champagne. They also own some still wine and spirits producers. And then there was us, the champagne specialists. So we would represent that portfolio. And I worked just exclusively with restaurants and mostly fine dining, because that was my background, to educate and inform, make placements, train the staff, do consumer events, all kinds of stuff, but mostly with an education bend.
You've been a manager of restaurants. You've worked with servers, other managers. You know, as the beverage person on the floor, on the team, like, a lot of your job is also to inspire people about the stories behind these products. I'm sure you've said things and watched reactions and, you know, nothing, you know, no reaction back. And then you've said some things and you see people light up. Like, how do you get people to light up about cool beverages?
A couple different ways. I do totally agree with that. I think that you sell more and more effectively with emotion and story than you do with like raw facts. And so I think a huge part of it, and this is not just exclusive to sommeliers, is you've got to be able to read the guest and really kind of get a sense for how they want to engage with you. And that was one of the really cool things at Alinea, is that the service was very highly choreographed and very precise. But if you're hitting all of those technical notes, it does allow you a fair amount of freedom to engage with your guests in like really fun ways. And so, I don't know, when people were down to like talk about the wines, I would, you know, and I've been lucky also, I have been able to travel a fair amount in my career. And oftentimes I would like to feature wines, you know, in the pairing that I was particularly excited about, that I had been to the estate, that I did meet the winemaker. I mean, I did the same thing with after coming back from Washington wine road trip. And so when you have like in your pocket, like a story that you're waiting to tell, and you see that a guest wants to hear more, like, you're teed up and you're ready to go. And it doesn't always work. I mean, sometimes I've told jokes to guests and like, they do not land, you know, you really, and I think I have a pretty good sense of reading people tableside, but I think you arm yourself with stuff that you're excited about and passionate about anyway. And then when the opportunity presents itself, you can pick how you want to present it to the guest.
You've also spent a ton of time studying, you know, chasing certifications. I mean, you could fill this in for me. Not only are you a master sommelier, you have your diploma with WSET, Certified Specialist of Wine. How do, in today's world where there's so much noise, there's so much distraction, how do you find time to focus? Like, do you find it harder to focus?
I think it actually, having a goal, and like the hardest part is organizing, you know, yourself to study and to prepare. But then when you kind of get into it, it helps block out the noise. I feel the same way about gardening. I used to think that when I would like mess around in the garden, it would be a good time to like review facts in my head. Turns out my mind goes completely blank when I garden. I think of literally nothing except for what's, you know, right in front of me. And I think studying, I don't dislike the routine of studying. And I know that sounds incredibly like maybe weird and antisocial, but I like to go out and be social. I like to like, you know, have my alone time as well. And when you're studying for something like, I don't know, Master Sommelier Theory, like you can't cut corners. It takes a tremendous amount of time and commitment to making that time. And I wasn't entirely upset about having to be like, no, I can't do that. I've got to study. It was totally an excuse to not hang out sometimes, but no, I don't mind the routine. I think actually it's kind of predictable, and that's not a bad thing always.
What is that routine? Because you've mastered studying, right? You've mastered
well-ish, I guess. What's that?
You've mastered that focus. Like, what is, if I want to study for any of these extreme tests that require a lot of hours and time, like, what are your go-to hacks to help people study better?
Ooh. Well, first, I think you have to create a schedule for yourself based on, and you have to, this requires advanced planning, right? You need to figure out, okay, when is my exam? How much, what am I supposed to be covering in this meantime? And then you've got to break it down. So like when I was studying for master's theory, there's actually a master sommelier who I was friends with who lived in Aspen at the same time, Sabato Sigaria. And he was like, I made a calendar for myself. And he's like, you just have to put stuff on paper, break it down. And he's like, the thing is you have to stick to your schedule. So I think sometimes people get really, they get sucked down a wormhole of something like some kind of minutia, or there's a region or a style of wine that they really like. And so they spend a little extra time, but it's like, nope, the week is over. Like you need to move on to a new subject because you'll never actually cover the depth and the breadth of the material. And I'm talking, this is like a plan that's like 9 months in the making before an exam. And you have to build in downtime. I didn't study every single day. It's very hard. I mean, you get a little OCD about it, but it's very hard when you get in the thick of it and in a routine to like take a day off. Cause you, I would sometimes get like a little panicky, like I could be doing more. I should be doing more, but you kind of have to, and you need to go hiking or skiing or gardening or go see a movie or something like that.
And then like these study sessions, like, I don't know, I'm fascinated by, you know, how people decide to focus. Like there's a, this new technique I read about, I'm kind of trying it, called the Pomodoro.
The what now?
It's called the Pomodoro technique. And basically what it is you set your alarm for 20 minutes and you just solely do whatever you're doing for 20 minutes. And then when 20 minutes is up, you take a 5 minute break and then you do another Pomodoro and then you take a 5 minute break and then you do another Pomodoro and then you take a 10 minute break or 20 minute break. And I need that because I'm the type of person, I just get so distracted. You know, if I see an email come in, I want to like look at it. If I, you know, it's like, it's just, for me, it's managing distraction. Like, what did your calendar look like that you're talking about? Was it like seven to eight is, you know, the 10 crews of Beaujolais, or what did that look like?
My calendar was based on weeks. So it was geographical regions or styles of wine broken into spending a week. And I made my own modifications. I wanted to build in some extra time for, you know, for various and sundry like minutia, but I didn't break it out during the day. And you got to keep in mind, I was in Aspen, Colorado when I was studying for master's theory, and it was off season. Like I wasn't working. I was like, and what I, so I did a few things. I would work on, first I would write like a little like study guide for myself. I would, you know, using a bunch of different sources, books, internet, whatever. I would like try to sum up, you know, a particular region or appellation, like with the like 12 things you really need to know. The grapes you can grow and any particular specific laws or terminology and any major geographical features and, you know, that kind of stuff. And then I would make sort of like flashcards for myself, but I used an electronic program that I don't even know who now told me about that people use when they're studying for the MCATs. And it has an algorithm that it, you assess how hard you think the question is after you see it, and it will bury it into a deck. You know, if you thought it was really easy, you won't, you build these decks of thousands of cards and you won't see that flashcard again for a long time because it was easy. But if it was hard, you can see it again in 20 seconds or 40 seconds or something. So I would make flashcards. Wow. I would draw maps, and then I recorded podcasts for myself. And so those same subjects, I would record on my computer, these like little 3 to 5 minute podcasts. And I've got like 30 hours of 3 to 5 minute podcasts. And so what I would do, you need to get some sunshine, is I would go, there was like a 3 mile cross country skiing loop, this nature preserve that was near my apartment in Aspen. And so I would take my cross country skis and I would just go do a couple of, you know, miles of loops. Cause the thing is cross country skiing, yeah, like it's really mellow. It's not dangerous. And so you can really zone out and listen to yourself, which is super boring. But I never did it when I was downhill skiing, cause I was always afraid, like I wouldn't either be listening to myself, so it wouldn't be a study, or I would like get distracted and kill myself. So cross country skiing was really helpful.
Oh, so you would listen to yourself.
Like, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I imagine that you were recording it while you're
crossing. Oh no. No, I would like just go skiing and like, you know, or go to the golf course and go to the course there and like just ski around cross country skiing, you know, doing my thing and just listen to myself, and I'd put it on shuffle. So there might be like a podcast on, you know, rum, and then there might be a podcast on, you know, Sonoma County and just all kinds of random stuff and German wine terminology or whatever. And so I would just do that because for the master's theory exam, it's an oral exam. So I wanted to get used to hearing stuff. And then of course I was probably looking like a lunatic because sometimes I would do ask and answer question sessions. So I'd be like talking to myself when I was out there skiing.
Jill, this is Jill.
Today, she a little crazy.
Going to the Loire Valley.
I know. Well, the funny thing is I don't listen to these anymore unless they come up on shuffle, like in my car. But sometimes clearly I was just exhausted and tired of studying. And like, I would bungle a pronunciation or just be like, I don't know what the fuck that is. And like, it would just go into, and I would keep recording and like, and then I wouldn't even realize I had said that. And then I would hear myself later on and it would crack me up.
That's so fun. I've never heard of anyone doing that. That's amazing. Like mini podcasts for yourself. Cause I mean, so much of it is, right? Like if you're learning any topic, if you can feed your brain and then repeat it to somebody or teach somebody else, that's what really cements it.
So, yeah, I agree. I mean, that's a well-known thing that, you know, if you're able to teach or explain something to someone, then like you have understanding of it. And that was just a helpful way you know, you practice the way you're going to play. So you know the format of the exam, you know, someone's going to ask you questions aloud. So you need to get used to hearing stuff rather than reading it on your computer. And so it was, it also allowed me to like multitask and like get some fresh air and then also study. So I felt super accomplished. Look at me, look at what I've done. I've studied for like 2 hours a day. I love that. Or, I mean, obviously I was studying more than that, but like during that ski session or whatever.
I've always known you to be one of the most outspoken people in the industry. You always speak your mind. You don't seem to have hesitation or fear to be outspoken when I'd imagine a lot of people do. How did that journey to find your voice go for you?
I think it was a long time coming, because when I first started working in wine, I was working as a sommelier for Jose Andres, and a lot of my contemporaries in DC either had more credentials or had been working in wine longer. I think honestly, I had some insecurity and fear, and no one ever said this to me, but I think in my mind, I was thinking like, they're going to think, why does this girl have this job? What, like, you're out of your league, sister. And so I think I was coming from a place of insecurity that like I needed to catch up to my peers who were older and more experienced. And I don't know if that's true or not. So I think that drove me to kind of really focus and acquire knowledge. And then I started to get opportunities to travel, which is not unique to me. I mean, a lot of people do. And one thing I realized, I think it was probably on a trip to Spain, and I met a friend who is still a friend to this day, Jen Knowles, and she is loud as hell. And she is incredibly smart. She asks all these questions. And at first I was like, oh my God, she's so loud. And then I was like, I appreciate how loud she is and how she is like sucking all of the information out of this. And I thought, that's the way to approach it. My shift kind of came where I would, you know, if I was attending a seminar or a tasting, like I'd sit myself in the front row and I ask questions. And I started to realize that there's this weird spot you get to where when you have less knowledge and confidence, you don't even know enough to know what questions to ask sometimes. And then as you start to get a little bit more knowledge, you understand what's being talked about in a way that suddenly you have a question that might actually be really thoughtful. And almost 100% of the time, wherever you're coming from, I realize that if you're in a group, a largish group, and you ask a question, someone else in the group probably wants to know the same thing. I mean, maybe not 100% of the time, but frequently people will be like, oh, I wanted to ask that same question. And I was like, well, I will be that person to do it. And so I became this like hand up front row sitter and asking questions, because I was like, I'm going to advocate for myself and try to accumulate all this knowledge. And I think with knowledge comes confidence, at least with regard particularly to wine. And I think that's what really kind of led to that. And then I start to realize, you don't realize it when you're in the middle of it, but then you start to realize like, you know, when I stepped out of restaurants in 2016, I'm like, well, I've been doing this for a long time. I didn't even think about that. Oh, I've been working for some pretty influential chefs in restaurants. I didn't really think about it because I was just in there doing it. And so you slowly start to realize that like, maybe what didn't bother you or what you put up with previously, you don't actually have to put up with that anymore. And you can actually feel completely justified in saying, that's not right. That's not correct. That's not okay. And I think it was this combination of just time, experience, and then the accumulation of knowledge.
Does anything come to mind, like a moment or an interaction at that time when you spoke up and you kind of watched yourself going, holy crap, I just did that?
Well, I mean, I do it a lot, so it's really hard to figure out. But I do remember just relatively recently. I mean, this was like a year ago or something like that. And I was pouring some of the champagnes that I represented for like a group of high net worth collectors. And this is a group of folks with lots of money and they buy lots and lots of wine and they're pretty knowledgeable. I mean, when people have, you know, when people are devoted collectors, oftentimes they focus on a specific style or a region or whatever, and they might know more like in depth and detail about that one kind of wine, but I might know, you know, more about the world of wine. It's not a competition to see who knows more, but it was really funny that there was one particular person at this tasting and started to rattle off about something. And I was like, no, that's not it. And I didn't think anything about it. And there wasn't tone involved. I was just like, no, that's not correct. And I just like went into like what the correction was. And I literally thought nothing of it because this person didn't seem to get too upset. But the proprietors of the shop where we were doing the tasting were like, holy shit, like, what did you do? And I was like, what? He's wrong. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, not point out that he's completely incorrect? Because that's not going to do him any services. I'm not going to shame him. I'm not going to make him feel bad, but I'm also going to be like, no, that's not right. And so I think about that kind of stuff. What's that?
You just shut down Champagne Charlie.
But it was really funny because the other people around were like, and I didn't actually think much about it. So I think sometimes I don't even realize how blunt I am and how outspoken I am.
But we need that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Outspoken people.
And I've noticed, I think relatively recently, and I've probably been a little bit more outspoken in the past couple of years anyway, that complete and total strangers who I do not know will like send me messages and like tell me that I should say things differently or talk differently because they don't think that my choice of words or my tone is appropriate. So like the tone policing trolls have come out, like total strangers. I don't know what in the world makes people think that they should like approach a strange woman and like tell her that she should watch her words or tone, but it happens to me with frequency. It's a weird new development.
Let's talk about that, right? The restaurant industry, the wine industry, it's been male dominated forever. What's been your journey as a female in that industry?
I think my journey has been maybe a little atypical because the very first sommelier I ever met was a woman, a Black woman, a Black Jamaican woman. And that's not very common in the world of wine. And so my first impression was everything she taught me. And she is incredibly warm and gracious and knowledgeable and hospitable. And so she taught me how to be a sommelier. But my impression—
What did she teach you? What like—
How to talk to guests. And how to upsell guests, how to make sure that you can take care of all of your tables when you are so, you know, eyes deep in the weeds, but no one ever sees it. Mm-hmm. And then how to see the world and make connections. I mean, my very first trip to Napa and Sonoma was with Nadine, and the restaurant closed for a couple of weeks in the summer when Congress was out of session because it was right on Capitol Hill. And she set up visits with producers and we went on a trip. And I got to meet all these people just tagging along with her. And it was incredibly eye-opening. I got to see so much about how the way of the world of wine works. And so that was my first kind of impression. It was like, I want to be like her. You know, she's a tremendous role model. So this is who I want to emulate. Nadine Brown, she's a rock star. And so that's not everyone else's first experience for sure. And then when I moved to Think Food Group, like I was saying, like as a company, their perspective in terms of how they would prepare and arm and teach their managers. And that's just, I don't think that that's atypical. I mean, I encounter people all the time who are in positions of relative power, you know, in their restaurants or their cities, and they don't know the kind of stuff that I'm surprised they don't know. And so I'm happy to teach and share, but I just kind of feel bad that they didn't have that opportunity as well. And when I was at Think Food Group, I worked with some really great women. Jose is amazing, but you know, there are some chefs that I worked with who are, you know, I'm friends with today, or my old boss, everyone's boss. And I thought she was the hardest manager, the hardest, you know, hard as nails. And I learned so much from her, how to interview someone, how to pull information out of someone when they're, you know, when they're hesitant to speak, how to lead people. And I did not realize at the time just how good she was. Probably the same thing with Nadine until you move on and then you work with people who maybe aren't as professional or aren't as tight or not as knowledgeable. And you're like, damn, I had it good. And so I think I was lucky, hashtag blessed, that I got to work with some very talented people relatively early in my career. And it's not like I took that for granted, but I realized in retrospect that lots of people did not have those kind of role models.
Whether you know it or not, I mean, you are an incredible voice for the female wine community. When we would come see you in Chicago, I mean, everybody talked about you. You were so eager to jump in and just do whatever needed to be done. It was like, we had an event in Chicago, and the woman that was supposed to pour with us went to the hospital last minute. And we were having a drink, and I was like, I got to go to this event, and we're down a person, I got to scramble. And you're like, I'll go. And you just jumped in. You stay there for 4 hours. You probably were the last one to shut up shop. Like, that level of professionalism and that just jump in and get done what needs to get done. You didn't hesitate.
That's really fun too. I mean, thank you. But like, I wouldn't hesitate to do that because my raison d'etre is apparently like talking to people about wine and, you know, pouring them glasses and, you know, telling stories and making people happy. So I derive a lot of joy from that. It's one of the reasons I like teaching so much. And it's one of the things I miss about the floor. It's that interaction, because I think you get a lot of positive reinforcement from it. Like, you share a little bit of knowledge, you pour something delicious for someone, and they're like, "You're amazing, I love you." You get a lot of positive feedback from that. And so no matter how shitty a night is in the restaurant, like, the minute we would call doors, it would evaporate, because it's like, I'm not an actor, but like, you know, you're on stage all of a sudden and the curtain goes up and show's on. And you just, everything else kind of fades in the background. And so I love that about the floor. It's what I love about wine service and what I love about teaching people about wine, because everything else kind of fades in the back and you're able to, you know, help people in their journey, inspire them. And plus, wine is delicious.
Well, you certainly lit up.
Added bonus. I mean, I had a couple glasses of wine that night, you know that, right?
Yeah, good on me. I was like, all right, give her a couple glasses of wine. We're down a person, Jill. Can you help us out?
Support your state one sip at a time. And drink for Washington. The wine the world is talking about is farmed and made by families right here. Now they need your help. So sip a cab or chill with rosé. However you enjoy wine, just make it a Washington wine. Raise a glass. Support your local wineries and drink for Washington. Brought to you by the farmers and families of Washington Wine, who encourage you to sip responsibly.
Now, you were in the group of Master Sommelier exam candidates that were embroiled in the cheating scandal in 2018. That must have been an incredibly tough experience. Tell me about it.
I don't think I'll cry, because it's been 2 years, but no promises. But it was one of the worst things in my life for a couple reasons. I mean, you'll have to totally edit this.
Yeah, whatever you like.
You work so hard. And for me, I passed the exam in 2018 on my fifth attempt. Wow. And nothing comes easy, I think, in the Master Sommelier exam, but I passed theory and service on my first time, and then I didn't pass tasting. So I reset. And so I had to take everything again. So I passed theory and service again on my reset attempt, but I still didn't pass tasting. Then I came back one last time in 2018 and passed tasting. And so it had been something that I had worked and changed my approach and really, really developed, you know, a method to improving and developing as a taster. And I finally got to a part where I was like, I feel good about this. I'm not throwing darts. Like, I'm a good taster. And it was wonderful. You know, it was everything that everyone says it's going to be. And then completely out of your control, you find out that people cheated. One of my best friends cheated. You know, people lied, people cheated, and they take it away. And the thing is, you can't just like rewind. You can't just erase it. I have the videos. I have the pictures. Like, it was incredibly special. I still have a, you know, like, screenshot of the, when Jose called my phone, because I was like, what the heck? You know, it was incredibly special. And so it was difficult. I drank a lot of tequila that day they called us, because, you know, you go from here to, you know, sub-basement. It was horrible. It was horrible. But, you know, shit happens. And I still think that, you know, we can still fix everything that was mishandled. I firmly believe that. But at the same time, you know, everybody responded very differently. And this is probably also where I got really outspoken, because some people just kind of hit the books and when we're like, okay, I'm going to roll with this, and like got real quiet. And I was like, I got real loud. And I felt and still feel that this is an experience that was forced on to me. This was not my choosing. No one in their right mind would ever, ever want to have this as part of their Master Sommelier experience. And so I was like, look, you did this to me, guys. I didn't cheat. Like, you did this to me. I will talk about it. And if anyone asks me a question about it, I will tell them honestly, because I got absolutely nothing to hide. And so I think that also probably turned up the volume on my outspokenness, you know, and like emptied out my like fucks to give jar, because I got none left, I think. And so it changed. And I said, you know, then, and I still say now, that no matter how anyone responded, it's completely okay. Like, if you got quiet and you accepted it, it's fine. I don't agree, but it's fine. And if you got loud and angry, that's fine too. And if you drank a lot, that's fine too. And, you know, if you screamed a lot, that's fine too. Like, you're allowed to respond however you want. And I did not intend on taking the test again, because I was just so angry. I honestly did not think that I could walk into the room. And in my mind's eye, I was like imagining flipping over the table, like Barbaral style, and being like, fuck this noise. Sorry about all the swears. But I like fantasized about doing that. And that's not constructive. That's not helpful. And so I didn't think I could like control my emotions. And so I wasn't entirely convinced I would go back. But because I guess I'm a little bit of a masochist, I was also preparing for another exam with the WSET finishing up my diploma. And so even though their structures of their exams are very different, I was going to have to be tasting wine. And so I was like, okay, fine. And I kept it very quiet. I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell my parents. And I just went back and went in, did the thing and left. And I passed it again.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not the same, and it never could be, because it was so great the first time that no matter what happened the next time, it's never going to be that good again. So it's nice, but it's not great.
Well, good for you. I mean, to be one of 26 women in the country that have passed this test, I mean, that's incredible. You know, as one of the foremost female wine professionals in the industry, you know, there's been a lot in the news. There's been a lot coming out about this industry and how we need to change and how it needs to be more open for women. Where do you see the positive change coming?
Oh, it needs to come from every possible venue. If you think about how the industry is broken up, I used to just work in restaurants, right? And I thought that being the sommelier of a, you know, influential or powerful restaurant, that was the center of the wine world. It's so far from the center of the wine world. But if we think about restaurants, they can be hot, angry, hostile, unprofessional, dangerous environments. You know, I think about places I worked where, you know, sexual harassment was, if not rampant, like maybe tolerated, or sarcastic and degrading comments were made towards women, or the simple fact of the matter. I mean, I remember like a huge locker room for all the men. And if you're one of the three women who works there and you don't feel like stripping down into your underwear and bra in front of everyone, like, then you can like hide in the corner. There was a cook at Alinea who used to change clothes, the one female, in the chemical closet. Like, that's unacceptable. Like, just don't put people in these positions, first of all. So restaurants, there's a lot restaurants could do. And I think it varies so widely that many are great, but there's so many, you know, there's books that have been written and there's, you know, like just my own experience tells me that like restaurants have not always been an easy place or a safe place for women. On the supplier, the import, the distributor side, like it's still male dominated in a lot of different ways. And so I am a believer that the field is never going to self-level on its own. That's a very sweet idea that like, oh, it's been a male dominated or a white male dominated industry, but you know what? Eventually that's going to change. You have to change things. And so you actually have to encourage and recruit and bring people in and hire people and promote people, women, people of color, to create a more diverse and a better environment, irrespective of which kind of branch of the wine industry that you're in. But I think you have to be proactive about it. And not everyone, people of different generations or backgrounds don't like that idea, but I think you actually have to work very hard to kind of correct the generations that didn't allow women and people of color to be in those positions. So I think you have to be proactive.
Thank you for all that you do. There's a lot of work that needs to be done, and I'm hoping that we're beginning that work.
I hope so too.
Let's change gears.
Okay.
We're going to do the Sommelite rapid fire question round.
Okay.
All right. What's your go-to dish that you make when entertaining?
I'm not a cook. Jeez.
You've worked at Alinea.
I don't cook.
It's like guacamole and tortilla chips.
Trying to think the last thing I cooked for something other than myself and like.
You don't asparagus-fy like olives and.
I'm so embarrassed. Like I usually like make a salad or like grill something. I am not a cook. I can't remember the last time I made something for someone else. Can I pass? I'm so embarrassed by that information or by that question.
I'm not coming over to your house when you invite me over to entertain.
Great seller. I mean, I'll open delicious wine.
I'll just eat food on the way there.
Potato chips and then some like delicious wine.
How about, okay, what's your go-to beverage that you open when somebody comes over to to entertain?
Oh, well, I try to always have like a house wine. And so it varies, usually something that's like on sale or closeout where you can buy like a case or two or three or something, you know, nothing expensive, nothing fancy. One year it was like a random case of like some Aligoté that I had, or it was rosé for the past 2 years, where it's just like screaming great deal. It's perfectly serviceable. It's not like contemplative, like serious wine. It's like, you know, patio pounder type stuff. So I always try to have some house wine around. But even from the very beginning of working in restaurants, I've, over my history, I've dated a fair amount of chefs, I suppose. And so I guess that's why I didn't do much cooking. But I always like this idea of having like a very hospitable setup for anyone who did want to come over. And so I like having a full bar, and I like having the, you know, different types of glassware and stuff that, and that's the restaurant, right? You like being prepared for, you know, I have my Bordeaux glasses and my Burgundy glasses, and I have my whiskey glasses, and I like to have all the setup, you know? So if somebody randomly wants a martini or a Manhattan, or if somebody wants, you know, a vodka soda, I can make those things happen. So I've got a very like well set up and stocked bar, both in, you know, tools and glassware and actual like booze. But yeah, in terms of a go-to, yeah, house wine, or there's always champagne in my house.
What's your go-to cocktail right now for yourself?
I have just recently switched to Manhattans. I'm very seasonal, and I was drinking a lot of gin and tonics over the summer. I always drink a lot of gin and tonics over the summer, but especially this year because I was furloughed for a while. So drinking a little bit more on the patio or on the back deck than usual, but it just got chilly in Chicago, and I'm pretty quick to change. I have been making Manhattans.
You're a seasonal spirit lady. What's your go-to running song?
Well, I have a pretty extensive mix, but I remember my friends, actually, this is a story from the Chicago Marathon, that some of my friends like were meeting me, I think it was like around mile 16, and like they had signs. And so like I stopped, and I had music in my ears, and like we're chatting, and like gave me a little water, gave me like an energy ball. And I had like one pod in my ear, and then like the other was hanging around my shoulders. And all of a sudden they tell me that I was like, oh my God, Lizzo's on, I gotta go. Like, take off. Cause like the right song had just come on. And I was like, I'm not missing this good beat. Like this is gonna motivate me. And they're like, Jill, it was so weird. Like you were just chilling, hanging out. And then you were like, there you go.
The power of Lizzo.
Power of Lizzo. She has great power.
Yeah. Have you ever gone through a car wash?
Yes. Oh, like, wait, like not in the car or just like.
That was the question.
Oh, well, I was like, I like taking my car through the car wash. And I like all the trippy like soap colors and stuff.
Jill, do not walk through a car wash.
Like, wait, what? Trick question is
I learned that the hard way. What does it feel like to complete a marathon?
It feels very good. And it there's like, I think a little bit of like a euphoria, like a little bit of a high that like, I'm so glad it's over. And there is a very weird sense of like inertia, because sometimes it hurts to keep going, but also it kind of hurts to stop. And so there is like a little bit of a weird, like, I don't know what to do. And then also very hungry and usually have to pee.
Do you have like a go-to meal, like the second you sit down after completing a marathon?
Well, I've run marathons in a couple different cities, and my meal after this, the Chicago Marathon ends in Millennium Park. And so I met some friends, one of whom was running and her husband at a restaurant just close by, and we drank champagne and ate burgers. So that was a solid post-meal, you know, post-race meal.
What's cuter, a bunny or a kitten?
I'm technically allergic to rabbits, so I will say kitten.
You're allergic to rabbits?
Just live ones. Like, I can eat them. Sounds terrible. Like, it's just, I don't know what it is, but kittens don't bother. I mean, they're both cute. Baby animals are cute.
So you're not allergic to dead rabbits?
No. Well, I guess if they had still had the fur on them, like, I would be allergic.
Okay. I'm imagining the rabbit carcass, I guess, not the rabbit food on the plate. You find a $1,000 bill on the ground. Mm-hmm. What do you do with it?
Funny story, and this might be too dark. Oh, there is a woman who I've never met, but I follow on the social medias, named Kat Kinsman. And I think she writes for Food and Wine or something.
Yes.
Like that. Anyway.
I love that.
Yeah. And I think she's great. I've never met her. And she posted something on a Twitter poll the other day. Because, you know, like the world is crazy right now. And there's just, you know, global pandemic and racial injustice and like political upheaval. And there's a lot, you know, like the the low like levels of anxiety are just like creeping up. And she posted something like, how much would you pay for someone that you know to very gently and like comfortingly come up behind you and like get you with a trank dart so you could sleep peacefully for the next 2 weeks? And the choices were like $10, $100, $1,000, or like a Scrooge McDuck swimming pool full of money. And I was like, $1,000. Like, I don't really want to spend $1,000 on anything right now. But I was like, if I could just like blissfully be unaware of like what's going on in the world for a couple weeks, I would like gladly pay $1,000.
That's awesome.
So if I found one, I would be like, Kinsman, somebody track me.
Somebody track me. Let's see. Pen and paper, you have.
I have.
We're going to do the Somlight Drawing Challenge.
All right.
We're going to put 45 seconds on the clock.
Okay.
I want you to tell us about the wines of the Pfalz in Germany.
Okay.
While drawing us a basketball star for UVA, shooting the championship free throw.
Oh my God, that's a hard thing to draw.
You're on the clock, Jill.
All right. So the Pfalz is one of 13 major wine producing regions in Germany. They're called Embaugebiete. And the Pfalz is an area where we typically see a lot of Riesling produced, and they happen to make a lot of dry Riesling. And so you see a lot of kind of powerful, high acid wines that have not a lot of residual sugar or anything like that. But they have kind of this bracing acidity and these floral notes and this kind of citrusy characteristic. And it's just, they're really delicious wines. And there's a misperception, I think, that all German wines are sweet. And so this is a great area where you can try like the powerful dry wines of Germany and understand that, you know, that's not the case for most of the wines.
Boom, you're done. I can't wait to see this. Look, you got 1 second left on the clock too.
He's already let the ball go. And so it's going to count when it goes in.
Oh, it's perfect. Is there an accident?
The stick figure's not good, but.
Was there an accident with the backboard?
I'm a dunk from before.
Somebody dunked it. You're still going to shoot the free throw though, John. Get out there. That was great. Thank you. I learned a lot about the Pfalz.
I'm like, it's really hard to do. And it's, you know, it's really funny. Like when I teach these classes on Zoom, like sometimes I'll put something in the chat and I like literally have to stop talking while I type because I can't.
Oh yeah.
And I wonder how I used to work in restaurants and like pour wine and like mark a table and clear and talk at the same time. Cause I think my skills have like the ability to like walk and talk have apparently, or walk and draw have not fared well.
Cause I'm like, I should do the walk and draw challenge next. Now for you, you've been out to Washington State. You've spent a lot of time with us. You've spent time with our winemakers and toured all around the state. For you, where does Washington State fit into the broader wine world? And what is it that makes our region unique?
Well, I think there's so much to love about Washington State. And I feel like at least what I encounter in consumers and some sommeliers is that the ignorance of what, you know, the quality and the diversity of the wines from Washington State is like covered up by saying like, just big, powerful reds. And very dismissive of that idea, because all you have to do is go to Washington State and realize that they do make big, powerful reds, but the high desert and the diurnal shift mean that they retain lots of fresh acidity. And that's a different characteristic than you get in other, you know, like powerful New World reds. And so they're actually quite fantastic. I really like Washington State Syrah. I love Riesling, even if I struggle to talk about Riesling when I'm drawing a basketball sketch. And so I as a generalist, I like all types of wine, and I usually say that I prefer to drink good wine made by cool people. And I have met a lot of cool Washington people. And so it's this nice combination of unique situation in Washington, Eastern Washington, where you can educate someone on, it's not just what you think. It's actually a pretty unique situation. The diversity of the different grape varieties and the freshness of the wines that are produced as a result, and also the people are cool.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for all that you do to support us and our wines in our region.
Happily.
Thank you, Jill, for being here today. Thank you all for listening. Stay well, stay healthy. We'll see you next week with some of our other favorite wine pros from around the country. Thanks, Jill.
My pleasure. Thank you.